Hiya, welcome to Into It. I'm Daniel Welsh and I'm with Rachel McGraw and Ash Percival to chat about the week's entertainment headlines. Today we're going to be chatting sexual violence on screen, the relevance of the singles chart in 2017, and we're finishing up with a bit of pop trivia. But before we get to that, I want to talk to yous about Strictly fans having the eyeballs ripped clean out of their head on the new tour. Have you guys heard about this? So, the Strictly Spectacular, it's happening later this year. It's a four-day event in London for Strictly fans. But it's kind of made headlines for all the wrong reasons, because tickets are already £70. And on top of that, it's been revealed that if you want to get your photo with some of the stars who are going to be there, it can cost you upwards of £300. So we'll break down how what you can be spending your money on in a little bit. But first of all, £70 plus hundreds on selfies. The question I want to ask is, basically, are they taking the piss? What do you think?
I mean, short answer, yes.
Yeah.
Put very simply, yes. Like, how I feel in this, it's, you know, it's going to be families that go. It's a family show. So, therefore, tickets for, like, two adults, £70 a pop. Child tickets, like, £30 a pop. Like, that's already, like, a good couple of hundred quid just to get through the door.
That's the thing. When I first saw the story, I saw £70 for a ticket, and I thought, well, that's fine. But that's me coming from a childless, single thing. You know, if I was going, I'd be going with my mates, and we'd all be spending £70 each. But when you're a family, and you're two parents, and you're paying for kids to go and meet all the people they've seen on the telly, it soon mounts up, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I didn't realise as well, because I saw £70 and I thought, well, that is obscene. And then I saw the things you could do there, and it's like, oh, you can sit at the judges panel and you can get your picture done with people. And I thought, oh, actually, that's not too bad.
Yeah,
but I didn't realise that you also then pay extra for all of those things.
Yeah, so I'll quickly go through what's going to cost you what. So if you go, you've already paid £70 just to get through the door. Then if you want your photo on the empty judges desk, that's £12. Photos with past contestants are £15, and that's with people like Nancy DeLolio, Jake Wood, and my favourite person ever to grace God's green earth, Alison Hammond. If you want a photo with professionals, that's £22, and then presenters and judges is £26.80.
It's just disgusting.
It's
like
£27 for a photo.
With Tess Daly. Like,
with
no
Tess
thanks.
Daly.
The thing is as well, I guess
you couldn't pay me £26 to have a photo with her.
The only kind of defence they can make is that it's a bit like Comic-Con, but that's such a different event.
It is.
I feel like that's the only kind of sort of way they can defend it, but it's still not valid.
So it came out that this is all this money for a selfie with the stars. The BBC have come out and said that this is not strictly true, by the way, and it is professionally, I'll read this out, I've got my official statement on my bit paper. Professionally, it's a professionally taken photograph, and guests will receive a high-quality, glossy print to take away with them. It's not just a selfie, which basically means a photography A-level student,
it's
I'm guessing.
It's a school photo, isn't it?
Yes,
it is. In front of a grey backdrop.
With Jake Wood and Nancy DeLolio.
So my biggest gripe with this whole thing, right, is the fact that, you know, they've kind of come out and said that this whole Strictly Spectacular is obviously for the fans, and, you know, it's for people that don't get tickets to see the live show. Tickets for the
which
live
is
shows
free.
Are like completely massively oversubscribed. Like, I think I read a stat last year that 5 million people applied to go and see Strictly last year. And obviously the studio can only hold, I think it's about 800 to 1,000 people. So you count that up over the weeks. There's millions and millions of disappointed people out there that can't go. So they're probably thinking, oh, you know, this will be great to go to. But actually, once they get there, they've been not only been kind of conned by the ticket price, they then get there and it's like, oh, actually, if I want to do this, I want to do that, it's going to cost me upwards of, you know, £200 to do all the extras. Yeah.
But it's not cheap to get a sandwich in there either.
Well, that's it.
Like, you know, we haven't even thought about lunch.
Practical mum thought over there.
Do you know what? Yeah, right, because stuff like all the food and stuff, and travel as well. You know, if I was coming from Newcastle or wherever, it would be like, you know, upwards of £200 a piece, but not on the travel, but on top of everything. Yeah. Just to walk away with it, with a photo of me and my mum sat on the desk, pretending to be Arlene Phillips.
Honestly. It's like you say there as well, Ash. It's kind of like, oh, this is for the people who haven't managed to get tickets. Like, oh, sorry you missed out on filming of the show, which is totally free. Come and pay £70 for this. It's just a bit of a kick in the teeth, really.
However, I've got to say, you do get... If you go, and this isn't one of the extra costs, you do get a dance lesson with some of the professionals, which I'm kind of tempted to pay £70 for. Yeah, it's not free.
It's included because,
but that's included in the ticket price. See, but I'm sure it's not one-on-one.
It's probably like 1 to 100 that you'll be in like this giant hall at the XL, like with Giovanni on a screen.
See, I think that sounds like my idea of hell, having to get up in front of like 10, 20, 50 people that I don't know and ballroom dance on me day off work. I think that sounds hellish.
Daniel, that's what we do every Tuesday.
What we do in my private time, Ash, is nobody's business. What I want to ask quickly is, £20 for a photo with Anton Dubek or Ali Ash, is there anyone that you would actually pay £20 to get a photo with?
Claudia Winkleman, maybe.
Oh, all right. I didn't just mean in Strictly. I just meant life in general. Oh. So, all right.
No.
Shooting for the stars there, Ash.
Unless someone was literally being raised from the dead. If they were like, you can get your photo with Elvis. He's back for like one day only. It's £20. I'd be like, you know what? Yeah.
Do you know what, though? You can go to Madame Tussauds for £20 and get your
can
photo
you?
With
is
Elvis.
Can you? Madame Tussauds is probably about 60-odd quid.
£60 to go to Madame Tussauds?
Yeah, like, yeah, it's to be not fair, cheap, this Strictly thing is probably priced in line with other stuff. It's not cheap.
Well, if it is that, let me tell you, I wouldn't thank you for a Madame Tussauds ticket. Madame Tussauds, if you're listening, I would actually thank you for a free ticket.
There's a whole list of people I'd pay to pose for photos, to be
really?
Fair.
Really? For £20?
Yeah.
I'll Photoshop you.
That's it. Madame Tussauds, man. Get yourself out. You can spend the whole day.
They've got the voice chairs now.
Got the voice chairs.
Seen the adverts at Warren Street Station.
All right.
That's revealed our location, Rachel.
Moving on from the free promo for Madame Tussauds and the voice, I want to chat about the new series of Broadchurch. So it's back and it's bigger than ever. And Julie Hesmond-Hall is in it, fresh from Coronation Street. And she's won a lot of praise for her portrayal of Trish, who is a victim of a sexual assault. She's come out and said that she is fed up of the way that sexual abuse is portrayed on screen. She says that she's sick of seeing, what is it she says, young women being chased through woods by predators. Rape is not an act of sex. It's not an act of desire. It's an act of violence. So with that in mind, how is Broadchurch actually doing in terms of its portrayal of sexual violence on screen, do we think?
I think it's doing quite well so far. So obviously they've put a sexual assault case at the centre of the whole drama, which is kind of in itself a really big statement. It's really good. It's like she said before, one of the other things Julie said was that she kind of had to face her own internalised misogyny, because as an older woman and an actor, you know, who's not in her 20s, she kind of found it hard at first to think about like, oh, how would this happen to me? This happens to younger women, not people like me. So I think even in just the act of putting it on screen with her in it, it deserves praise, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think the other thing I think is really good, which we've kind of talked about in the office, is how they're kind of, they've done their best at not doing like a whodunit around the rape. So rather than being like, oh, can you guess who did it? Which, to be honest, is crass. And
it's
not
quite trivialising of
it's
the
just,
issue,
it's
isn't
just
it?
Not good. I just think it's a really horrible road if people go down that. One of the things they've done quite well is they've kind of presented different elements of the case that need solving. So at the moment, it's sort of, you know, oh, why doesn't this person want to give DNA evidence? Or, you know, what, where did it actually take place? We're kind of looking at smaller elements of it rather than this grand whodunit style thing.
I think it'd be more interesting to see how the media is going to go around it, because you can see how they're going to go down the whodunit route, as they did with, obviously, with the Who Killed Danny Latimer storyline, which was the first series. You know, I think it is dangerous ground to be going down of doing a whodunit with a rape storyline. But at the moment, I agree with you. I think they're doing it in a sensitive way. Whether that will change in the next, you know, we've still got, I think, 6 episodes left of the series. I don't know. Remains to be seen, I think.
The other thing that's been really good, is that they've kind of had this female police officer character who's been very, very sceptical of Trish, who the sexual assault happened to. And every single time she is, Olivia Colman's character makes this very big show of, quite frankly, putting her in her place and explaining why she's wrong. And I think those discussions are really interesting, because the female policewoman who doubts her perhaps says a lot of things that some people at home might think. Like, she comes out with things and says, oh, how do we know she's telling the truth? Or like, why don't we question her about this? And it's really good to show on screen her being told why that stance should not be taken.
Well, it's like what you said about Julie Hesmond-Hall, like addressing her inner misogyny and her inner thought about sexual assault in general. That's maybe a view that a lot of people might have, that, you know, this sort of thing wouldn't happen to people of a certain age bracket or who looked a certain way.
Yeah.
And so putting it on screen in that way, do you think that's helpful as well?
I think so, yeah, definitely. And it's like she said as well, like, rape is like, is a crime of violence. It's not a, like, it is obviously a sex crime, but fundamentally it's a violent act. It's like a violent robbery. And it is important to show that this happens to like all sorts of different women and in all sorts of different circumstances. So yeah, so far I think that they definitely deserve the praise that has come.
I mean, I agree with like 90% of what she said. There is like a 10% that I don't agree with, and it's representations of sexual violence on screen. I actually think she's downplayed and discredited quite a lot of work that's actually been done on like soaps and stuff. You know, we had the Linda Carter rape storyline on EastEnders a couple of years ago, and I thought that was dealt with like absolutely brilliantly. It was done within a family, so it wasn't a predator that someone might have thought jumped out on them in the street. It was someone in the family that the victim knew. So, you know,
that's one in 2 years. Like, no, I can't name another one.
Can you name any way you think that maybe it hasn't been handled very well? Anybody off the top of their head that maybe this Broadchurch might want to avoid? I mean, you've mentioned Coronation Street, Toya Battersby, which was very much played out as a whodunit. And I remember even the promo around that was like, they had all of the men in Coronation Street in a line. And the idea was for the viewer to guess which one
it was. Well, it was a reaction to Who Shot Phil, wasn't it? That was their kind of response to the huge Who Shot Phil storyline on EastEnders.
But of course that was 15 years ago now as well. So, you know, attitudes to things like rape have changed as well. Producers have worked with Rape Crisis as well, haven't they? Is that really clear when you watch it? Is it obvious?
Yeah, definitely. So like, I think it's probably something that, like, you know, I write and read around like women's issues quite a lot. But so far in these two episodes, I feel like I've learned quite a lot about what actually happens to somebody. Like they showed kind of Trish being taken to the centre and they, you know, you saw her, it being explained to her like what would happen and how they would process the evidence and things like that. And I've actually genuinely learned so much about what that process involves.
It's very procedural, isn't it?
Yeah,
it deals with the procedure in a like a really human way, I think.
Well, like in the most recent one as well, so one of the things that you saw was basically Trish has to give this video interview and that is what will go to court. And there's kind of this pressure that she needs to give it quite soon, but also she's not ready for it. And that's obviously something that many women go through.
Yeah, a lot of victims will have that.
I'm 25 process. And I'm learning this on Broadchurch. That should not be happening.
That's it. I mean, I'm not watching Broadchurch. I'm learning it, recording this podcast with you. So yeah. I think obviously they're doing a really good job. Broadchurch is on, when is it?
Mondays at 9.
Nice.
ITV.
On ITV. I need to catch up on that, clearly. Really quickly, I want to talk about Ed Sheeran as well, because at the time of recording this, so obviously the charts haven't been announced yet. So if you're listening to this in the future, appalls if we got it wrong. but at the time of recording, it looks like he's set to take 9 of the top 10 slots in this week's top 10. He's released his new album,
Divide.
It called? It's Divide Sign anyway, so wherever it is. We need to get Carol Vordman on the case. she's a woman who would know. So 9 of the top 10 this week is going to be Ed Sheeran in the singles chart. And obviously that's all down to streaming. So streaming was introduced 2014 to the UK singles chart, and it's had quite a big effect, especially in latter years. At first it didn't really seem to matter that much, but now it's had a big change, and we're seeing a lot of, when somebody releases a big album like this, a lot of the songs are all taken up place in the chart. We saw it with Justin Bieber last year as well. So what do we think? Is streaming killing the chart, or is this just a reflection of what music is like now?
I would like to say both.
Oh.
I think that it has, obviously. Like, this week's chart is now a bit of a write-off. And also, the thing that gets me is he's going to potentially have these 9 slots because everyone's listening to the album. And it'll also obviously top the album bit. I think maybe they need to kind of look at how the singles are taken into account or something.
I think, they need to more clearly define, if they're going to keep streaming in, which obviously they are because it's the future,
they need to redefine
what a single is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, make singles official. So if you release an official single, that is the only
one that's then eligible to go into that chart.
But I think it's just symptomatic of the fact that people just don't really care about the singles chart anymore, to be honest. Like, when was the last time that you tuned into the top 40 or,
you only care, you know, Christmas, looked at the chart?
Exactly. Like, I remember, I don't know whether this is hazy 90s nostalgia, but I can remember, like, religiously tuning into the top 40 every single week. Might have been plagiarizing some of the songs.
Yeah, he had to make a tape.
What a thought.
You know, I was obsessed with the charts as a kid, and I think if pop music was still exciting, I think I would still take an interest in it. But I just think now, because it with everything's so predictable through streaming and albums.
That's the thing, it's not worth it anymore, is it?
Yeah, it's not worth my investment.
I think about, like, it was either last year or the year before. I think it was 2 years ago now when it had come in. Was that when we had the big album? You know, there was that, like, a couple of months for albums where it was like Adele, Little Mix, One Direction. You know, when all of those albums came out?
Oh, last November. Yeah.
And like,
there
was
a lot of big people.
That was a really big kind of time for the charts. But it's like you say, that wasn't about the singles, that was the album chart.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the album chart because, you know, Ash, you just said nobody cares about the chart. But last week, we were all sat at our desks waiting to find out if Stormzy had got the number one album. And we were all really excited when it turned out that he had. And so I think maybe, you know, albums are much more reflective of sales, and that's how you end up getting people like Bradley Walsh and Alexander Armstrong and Alan Jones
and people top of the album chart. Do still, some people, obviously not everyone, but some people do still buy physical albums.
Yeah,
like, people don't buy
for
physical
the car
singles
especially
anymore.
I think the majority of people buying albums now would be deliberately to get it in the chart or for the car
or
nanas
present.
Or
yeah,
exactly, or for somebody who hasn't quite mastered streaming yet. Like me mother. Like, she still gets a CD at Christmas.
I think it's kind of good, though, because it gives people, like, gives artists nowhere to hide. Like, yeah, in the album chart before, I just feel like, you know, if things are on offer, they can still be, like, eligible, and you could kind of almost, it was a lot easier to perpetrate the myth that someone was doing really, really well. Whereas with the streaming chart now, that's what people are listening to, end of. It's so, it gives you nowhere to hide.
Well, I think with that, Honey G released her single in
exactly
December. And, you know, 5-6 years ago, that would have been top 10, definitely, just off Kids, running to Woolworths, buying the CD.
Done.
Yeah, done. Listen to it twice. Honey G, she's funny. She's got a stupid hat on. Away you go. But, you know, because of streaming, because people don't actually want to listen to that song, it got to number 149. You know, we completely missed the top 100. Only just made the 150. And I think that shows, you know, Simon Cowell would happily have spun her as, oh, you know, this is what the kids want. This is, you know, it's a bit fun. But actually, the statistics are there. The receipts are there.
Well, they tried.
Nobody cares.
They really tried to make out like everybody cared about what she was doing. And it's like you say, it just outed her. And it actually, nobody gave a shit.
What I'm intrigued about, though, which kind of follows on from what you were saying earlier, Rachel, like, you know, you can put offers on CDs and make them to make it skewed in the charts. But I wonder about the effect of having like featured spots on streaming services. So, you know, if you go onto Apple Music, you land on the homepage and it's like new this week. And there's like five songs that are out this week that they're recommending for you. How much is that affecting? Like people just go, right, well, I'm just going to play that playlist today.
Well, that's interesting.
And that's skewing
I
then the charts.
I don't have Apple Music. I'm like the only person in the world who still uses Tidal. But, like, I know that Spotify as well, they have the chart. I know a lot of people listen to music on that. And so it ends up being a vicious circle because the stuff you're listening to on the Spotify chart then ends up being in the real chart. So it stays in the Spotify chart. And then, that's how people like Drake end up being number one for 15 weeks because it's just this vicious circle of, oh, it's in the real chart, so therefore it's in the Spotify chart.
Well, like, I learned about this today, actually. But there's kind of all sorts of different concessions that they make around, like, physical sales of albums. So if an album is reduced to a certain, like, level, then it can't be eligible. If the deluxe edition isn't different enough from the normal one, that's not eligible for sales either. So it'd be quite interesting to see if they have, or maybe they should have, you know, kind of rules around these things that you've said.
Mm. I'd love to get a chart expert in to just cut into this.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I'm excited for next week when we find out if Steps have beat Ed Sheeran.
Yes. Come on, Steps.
That's the real chart battle I'm interested in. Following on from that discussion, just fancy wrapping up with a bit of a pop quiz.
Oh, yeah.
Always.
So inspired by Ed Sheeran and his 9 top 10 singles this week, which aren't even necessarily singles, I'm going to test your knowledge of who's had the most number ones.
Ooh.
So I'm going to give you each a pair of people, and you just tell us basically who's had the most UK number one singles.
Okay.
Okay.
This is with them listed as a featured or main artist.
Okay.
This is like pointless where you have to really
get the rules. I've got to get in there because I'm not having any complaints about my Wikipedia searches anymore.
We all know what happened last time, Daniel.
All right, Ash, I'm coming to you first, right? Because last week Rachel wiped the floor with you. So we're going to come back.
Yeah, we all know why that was.
We're going to come back strong, Ash. I've got faith in you. Right, so Melanie C and Jerry Halliwell, who's had the most number ones, including their Spice Girls number ones?
And this is singles.
This is singles.
So I would say Mel C's probably gone. She's had like a longer career, but I would say that Jerry probably was more successful back in the day. So I think I'm going to go Jerry.
Right, well, I've dobbed you over and I forgot to mention one crucial part. which is that which is that they can have equal amounts and they've had the same number ones. They've had
I get that point.
They've had 11 each, so I'll give it to you because Jerry had the most solo success. Jerry had four solo number ones. Mel C had two. But Mel C had two extra Spice Girls number ones as well, which is how they've ended up with.
How did she have? Oh, yeah.
Because they had two number ones without Jerry, didn't they? All right, I'm sorry. I thought I'd laid all the terms and conditions out. This
is why. Also, part of a group. Is this part of the specifications?
Well, yeah, sure it is.
We'll just explain it at some other point.
We'll do it as we go along. Ash, you got the point,
girl. We'll add a disclaimer to next week's episode.
Take a point, be done with it.
Yeah. Rachel, similarly, right, this is including with Take That. Who's had the most number ones? Gary Barlow or Robbie Williams?
Okay.
Ooh.
This is hard because I feel like That must have had a lot of number ones without Robbie. This is also not my... I feel like Ash would know this and I'm going to guess. I'm going to say Gary.
That's the correct
answer. That's what I would have said.
Gary actually had three solo number ones, including that one he did for the Queen that time when he was begging for his OPE. Do you remember that? Yeah. Do you remember that?
No.
It's embarrassing, wasn't it? He had two before that as well and 12 with Take That. And okay. Robbie's had seven solo and seven with Take That. Ashley... Kylie Minogue or Madonna, who's had the most UK number ones?
I'm going to go Kylie.
Oh, Ash, you're wrong. Madonna's had a considerably
That was such a quick decision number. As well.
That was a real snap decision and it's one I'm now really regretting.
Kylie's had seven number ones in the UK and Madonna has had 13. So it's nearly double. Guess what Kylie's last number one was, incidentally?
Was it a long time ago?
It was Can't Get You Out of My Bloody Head. Yeah. It was ages ago.
Oh, no, that was number two, wasn't it?
Ages ago, innit?
2001.
Yeah. Rachel, Mariah Carey or Jennifer Lopez, who's had the most UK number one singles?
Does this include if Mariah's Christmas song just constantly goes back to number one?
I don't think it's ever been
number
one.
Did it ever top it?
It's actually never
topped
the singles chart, no.
Well, that's disgusting for a start.
start a campaign for next year.
You know what? On that basis that the public clearly don't know anything, although I do love J-Lo, I'm going to say J-Lo.
J-Lo is correct. She's had three and Mariah's only had two.
Really?
I'm going to tell you what those are because they're hilarious. One was Without You way back when and the second number one she had was Against All Odds with Westlife.
That is such
a power of Westlife,
innit?
The power of Westlife indeed. So one each at the minute. Rachel's winning actually.
No, I'm winning.
Oh, yeah. Why can't I pay attention? Ashley, One Direction or JLS, who's had the most number ones as a main or featured artist?
Oh, One Direction.
Actually incorrect.
Really?
Yeah, One Direction had five number ones and JLS had six.
But what about Zayn?
Zayn ain't One Direction.
So it doesn't work in reverse.
Oh yeah, this isn't including all of their members. That was made clear.
Was clear.
Yeah.
Those T's and C's should have been set out at the start.
Do you know what? Next time I'm bringing the law department with this. All right, Rachel, I'm coming to you. If you get this, you've won.
Okay.
Britney Spears or Beyoncé, who's had the most number ones?
Go on.
And we're including Destiny's Child.
This is also not a diss to Britney, but given that the public know nothing, no offence, is it Britney?
It's not.
Oh, well, that makes me happy.
Including Destiny's Child, Beyoncé's had seven, but as a solo artist, she's had five, and Britney's had six.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So as a solo artist, Britney's got the most. But if you include Destiny's Child, which we were, then Beyoncé wins. Right, Rachel, congratulations. You've won the quiz, mate.
Thanks very much. Yeah, again.
It's 2 weeks in a row. Ashley, you want to sort it out, girl?
Well, you want to sort it out with your T's and C's.
A bad workman always blames his tools.
Well, it's not my tools. It's Daniel's tools.
There you go. That counts.
Nobody's blaming my tools for anything. And on that note, we'll be back next week. Don't forget to subscribe. Laters!